This clandestinely distributed podcast program involves indiscreet communications of a most sensitive nature. Execute extreme caution if listening in an unsecured location.
So this is Bonding Agents. Originally intended to call it James Bonding, but...
James Bonding Podcast, 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 James Bonding Podcast.
Bonding Agents is intended to be the father and son Spy-Fi podcast. I'm Diablo Frank, and with me is...
Dude, I forgot my anonym.
Old dude?
Old dude, yeah, that's right, I forgot. Okay.
So
looked in the mirror too, just this morning.
Do you know what Spy-Fi is, though?
Huh?
Do you know what Spy-Fi is? Can you define it?
Spy-Fi?
Yeah.
Well, judging by the term you just said, it's, you know, spies and science fiction all rolled up into one, which is pretty accurate.
It's all that super high-tech, 60s-style adventures where it's not real legit Cold War type of spy
but
stuff. It's
you,
a fantasy version.
At the time, a lot of people believed it was.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, we believe that all the secret agents had all that stuff, man. You look at that stuff today a lot of times, and you see it as hokey. We saw it, we go, wow, we always knew they had that. I wish we could get it.
J. Edgar Hoover had a kind of a campaign, especially, I think, in the 50s, where he pushed the idea of this clean-cut, well-dressed FBI agent that was completely without error. If they came for you, they'd find you, they'd catch you no matter what. They were just the top-of-the-line best people in the world, the most dangerous people in the world, potentially. Public information campaign or disinformation campaign, depending on how you look at it, to basically intimidate people if they came into contact with the FBI, to make them seem like they were like almost like superior beings, where if they were onto you, you might as well just give up, throw up your hands, because you aren't going to be able to get away from these guys. And then I imagine they would be inclined to want to play up that 60s Spy-Fi flavor, where we've got all the best technology, we've got all the best people.
At that time, everybody wanted to believe the American fantasy. You had Ozzie and Harriet. You had the Cleaver. And you think about this, and Lucy, just take all them women. They all wore dresses. They all wore a pearl. There were people that tried to emulate that. My own father dressed like they did in I Spy. He had a skinny belt and a skinny tie. Now, you wouldn't see him caught dead with white socks, but his shoes were always so shiny you could see your face in them. People then emulated that, because I don't know if Hoover did that. I mean, I never really thought about it or looked into it. I wouldn't doubt that, but I just know how Americans work. I mean, my own mother would not allow me to wear tennis shoes or blue jeans. Poor people did that. We weren't going to do that. I wore slacks and Oxford. Had a flat top. The clean cut all-American stuff, that was just of the time. And some of that stuff did exist. The scopes on the guns in Man from U.N.C.L.E. They were supposed to be infrared scopes, and they were. That was the closest thing to night vision they had back then, and they weren't very good, but they did work. But nobody watching TV knew that, see? The guns were all made up pretend stuff, but not the scopes that were on. I guess it's just how you look at it and how far into the propaganda you go.
Kind of a fake it until you make it American exceptionalism,
yeah,
it sounds like.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of the stuff didn't exist. But we know now, a lot of that stuff, microfilm existed, and man believed believe me, you watch any of that stuff, I don't care what show it is, they made a big deal of microfilm, and I don't think it became passé until sometime late in the 80s.
What was your first exposure to Spy-Fi?
I don't know. I guess probably I Spy Man from U.N.C.L.E. I mean, I watched Peter Gunn, which was kind of, sort
of,
he was a detective, you know.
Yeah, there
was
a flashy detective and Henry Mancini score, so that definitely sounds probably influenced the Bond sound and that bass-driven music that got associated with Spy-Fi movies.
Went into Wild Wild West, but I'm pretty sure I Spy was the first.
And you told me before that you were a big fan of I Spy.
Oh yeah, it may be one of the reasons why I've never been prejudiced. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but it probably is. It probably, because I was pretty young, I probably saw a black man as an intelligent individual, and it stuck.
One of the great crises with history is that you can do an enormous amount of good and an enormous amount of evil, sometimes simultaneously. It's up to retrospective to determine how people are going to feel about you over that.
Cosby's co-star was Robert Culp. My father, we were raised on Western. I mean, you know, Westerns were a big thing in the 50s. And the 60s, and into the 70s. But Robert Culp was on he starred on a show called Trackdown.
Trackdown.
And you would have to watch Trackdown and watch I Spy because he is completely different. There's no similarity between the two. Probably the only time in Robert Culp's life where there wasn't. Because for the rest of his life, he pretty much kind of played the same character.
One of the things that gets me whenever you see nostalgia programming where they try to recapture a time period is they always set it so precisely. Like for me growing up, everybody would assume they would be nothing but Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Transformers and that kind of thing. But what they never seem to factor into those pieces is that a lot of your nostalgia is actually hand-me-down in the period. A lot of my culture was actually stuff that was leftovers from your childhood. You know, when I bought comic books at a flea market, they'd be stuff from the mid and late 60s. The TV shows, we didn't get to watch, you know, if you're something that was popular then and there, it would be once a week on broadcast television. So that didn't factor in all the stuff that was on the UHF channels, all the stuff that'd be playing, you know, on afternoons and weekends and stuff. So even though the heyday of Spy-Fi was in the mid 60s, when I was growing up, that was all over my cultural landscape. My uncle was a big fan of Strange Tales, the comic book, and he left me a ton of those issues, which co-featured Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., all that great Stranko artwork. And of course, that was something that was dear to me as a child. On TV, they would have, I didn't really watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E. too much. I never had a lot of exposure to I Spy. It never seemed to turn up. But I remember it was a big deal when Channel 51 came on, because we only had a handful of stations as a kid, and Channel 51 used to run a lot of older shows, so they'd run The Spirit, they'd run, but they didn't have a Secret Agent Man, right? It was called something else? Was it Danger Man?
No. There was a
Secret Agent Man.
I watched it. It was called Secret Agent Man. In fact, that, what is it, Eddie Rabbit song?
Johnny Rivers.
Johnny Rivers song. So, hey, that's the theme song to that show.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Agent Man, Secret Agent Man, they've given you number and taking away your name.
Back then, especially, James Bond was still event television. I think ABC had the rights when I was a kid. That'd be their Sunday night movie at least every season. Whenever they would have a new broadcast premiere of a new Bond movie, it was always an event. And so I was kind of seeped in that hand-me-down culture. It wasn't for my time period, but I enjoyed it in part because it was so optimistic, such a big manifestation of the brave new frontier, Camelot, and the world of democracy and freedom and justice that was sold to us regardless of what the actual facts facts of the matter ended up being. And because it's a combination of spy stuff and science fiction, it felt closer to the world that we were still living in, because Cold War was still in effect in my childhood. And really, arguably, it never went away entirely. You know, look at modern events. We're still having our issues with the Russians, for instance. But because it's science fiction, it was so much more hopeful, and it was so much more technology positive. We won the World War II because of our technology. Not just the bomb, but all the technological advances that came out during
that
time period.
Industrial might.
Yeah.
Our technology had nothing to do with it. The war was going on over there, and their productions, their being able to get materials, being able to manufacture materials. See, that none of that affected us.
Yeah, we never had our production lines disrupted by bombings.
America has never seen a boom time as they did in World War II. You know, the men were fighting war, and the women and men left over were working as hard as they could, making money and building bombs and airplanes and tanks, what have you. And the evidence of that is, look at cars. Look at the cars up to the beginning of World War II, and then all during the World War II year, there weren't many. There wasn't very many made. There wasn't much variety. And that's because those auto plants were turning out war goods. I worked for a company. It was an oil field equipment company called McAvoy. They make wellhead equipment, or did. But during the war years, they made tripods for machine guns.
That's kind of where the American century came from, is that the U.S. didn't get blown up like a whole bunch of the rest of the world, especially the industrialized world. So the rest of the world was dependent on us to make stuff for them and have access to those resources, have access to that production. And also, we did have a lot of technological advances that came out of the war, and also technological advances that came out of the space race. Technology was just making leaps and bounds. Initially, a lot of that stuff was still coming out of the U.S. And so there was this perception that we would dominate, but obviously it was a temporary boom. Once Europe got their production back up again, once Asian countries really entered the marketplace and showed that they understood that the idea was to go small, not to go big like we did, that technology would advance there rather than here. It's funny because we got so many people in this modern day that want to go back to the 50s and 60s without seeming to understand that was a very specific time and a very specific circumstance that allowed America to boom the way that it did, and those circumstances aren't in play anymore.
Well, we didn't have UHF, okay? So you think you didn't have enough channels on TV? We had three. Some of them didn't make it to midnight. I remember when the first UHF came out, they were real weak. Well, I said we had three. Here in Houston, they had four.
Because we always forget PBS.
Well, kind of, sort of. But, you know, it had a very limited broadcast period.
Well, that's where a lot of that hand-me-down culture came from, too, is just the fact that because there was so limited amount of television, when I was growing up, everything that had been made was getting thrown out there if there was an avenue for it. So we watched stuff from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, because there was only a handful of channels, and there had only been a handful of channels, even less so. All the content that people wanted was available because there wasn't that much to begin with, it seemed like.
KH TV shows a movie every night at 8. We play favorites old and new, but never out of date.
This week on Channel 39, the entertainment is divine. And we thought that we should mention that we're not showing the convention. We hope that you might like to see a movie, not a nominee. And we show movies guaranteed on Channel 39.
Tuesday night on 39, humanity is on the line. Post-atomic chaos fell and left the Earth a living hell. A few escaped the Holocaust, but his status man had lost. Into a world of apes he's tossed in the battle for the planet of the apes. The apes control society, which causes man anxiety. Man thinks it is a true disaster, having a monkey as his master. John Huston stars in All Who Airs, and Rob McDowell will cause nightmares. So plan to watch this apish fair on Tuesday night at 8.
KHTV shows a movie every night at 8. We play favorites just you watch on 39 at 8.
Yeah, well, I can just tell you, in 1975, I worked second shift. And when I got off work, there was nothing on. You know, Channel 13 was the one that kept experimenting, testing the market till about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with these late movies. You had the late movie and then the late movie.
Right. And I remember with 13 in particular, that was always the last station left.
Stay tuned for 13's all-night movies, immediately following Meditations.
The preacher would come on and do a sermon for like 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I'm the Reverend A.C. Nelson, Jr., the pastor of the Nelson Memorial Pentecostal Church of God in Christ. That's located at 5914 Wayne Street here in the city of Houston in the Cashmere Gardens edition.
And then you'd get the national anthem with all the flags waving, everything, and then you'd get the test picture or the color bars.
That's right.
Good morning. This is KTRK-TV, Houston, Texas, Channel 13. KTRK-TV is owned and operated by Capital Cities ABC Incorporated, with studios at 3310 Bissonnette in Houston. Our transmitter facilities are located 4 miles southeast of Missouri City. KTRK is licensed to operate on Channel 13 at a frequency of 210 to 216 megacycles and a maximum power of 316,000 watts. This by authority of the Federal Communications Commission. The programs broadcast by this station may not be used for any purpose except exhibition at the time of their broadcast on receivers of the ordinary type used for home reception in places where no admission, cover, or mechanical operating charges are made. Portions of today's programming are pre-recorded or mechanically reproduced. Ladies and gentlemen, our national anthem.
I think with 13, when I was a kid, they went off the air sometime between 1 and 3, and they stayed off the air until like 5 or 6.
Yeah.
So
and
they still
think about what year that was. Trust me, in the 60s, I mean, most sign-offs was 10:45. And there was almost always a channel, even when I lived in Tennessee, that would go right up to midnight, like 11:55. It was like that forever. Yeah, it's hard for somebody nowadays. I mean, like, y'all have, you never experienced blue law. Yet.
Well, there's still blue laws. You still can't buy liquor on a Sunday in town.
Son, I'm talking about you couldn't go to a Kmart and buy anything.
Oh, yeah?
The Kmarts that had, like, pharmacies and grocery stores in them, you could go in them and buy groceries and pharmaceutical goods. Everything else, they threw these big sheets, these big covers over everything else in the store, and so usually roped off those areas. You couldn't even go and window shop. And it was like that way up into the, just about the 80s. There was no such thing as clubs. You had lounges and you had ice houses, beer joint. There was no liquor by the drink. All that stuff took place in the 80s. For somebody like me, you can imagine, because things like you said, when I was coming up, we did have Kmart, but Kmarts didn't sell groceries in my, it wasn't until I was grown that some Kmarts were big enough to do that. It was a different time. There was no Walmart. Most stores, I mean, the big stores you went to were like Sears. And on Sundays, they were closed. They weren't open. They just were closed. They didn't cover anything up. So when you talk about something like that in a retrospective, you have to try to put the person in that time. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any sense. It's hard for somebody to imagine. These kids today, they're not going to be able to imagine a time when you didn't have a computer on your telephone. Your nieces and nephews and great nieces, and let's not forget, you know, you've got great nieces and nephews now. They find, because I still have regular telephone, push button phones, they find those absolutely fascinating because they don't have them and they live in the country.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, they had to call mama on this. Wow, what is that? They didn't even know what it was. Looking at the, what is that? It's a telephone. It is? Can I use it?
Given where you were coming from, do you think that played into the appeal of this genre where it's all cosmopolitan and sex appeal and danger and world stakes?
It was racy. It was cosmopolitan. It was something that was exciting because it didn't exist in suburban America. But they're saying it does exist. And of course, people who travel would say, you know, some of that stuff does exist. You're talking about a time when foreign car, you might see a Volkswagen Beetle or Carmen Ghia every once in a while. Those didn't even hit the streets in volume until the late 60s. So, you know, and you might even actually see a Volvo every once in a while. There were a few foreign cars around, but they were very, very rare. You might see a Triumph or MG, but they were really rare. And rarely in your neighborhood. You know, when you saw somebody, when you saw like an MG Roadster parked on the side of the road, you walked around it a few times. American Chrome. That's what we had. Big American Chrome. Even our sports cars.
How did you get introduced to James Bond? What are your earliest memories of the character?
Bond was mentioned a lot, but in the 60s, he was risque for a lot of adults, let alone children. You heard about him, and you heard the noise about him. I can even remember when I was 9, reading a Playboy art. Some boy in the neighborhood swiped his daddy's Playboy, and we were up under the house. All the houses back then weren't built on slabs. They were pier and beam. And so we all had playhouses under our houses, sitting up under the house, looking at the Playboy, and reading about James Bond, you know. But I wouldn't go so far as to say I started with reading articles in Playboy, because I think even at that age, I was looking at something else. But while we were there, we'd already looked at them. I took the time to read stuff on James Bond. But really, I got the most interested in it after seeing Our Man Flint.
When about was that? Did you see it in the theater?
Yeah, Our Man Flint.
Mm-hmm. So when about was that, though, year-wise?
I think that was about 1966.
Okay.
We were talking about it earlier. I thought Thunderball was the first one that I'd seen in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize now, yes, I did. But it was in a Saturday matinee about 1966, so it was an old movie by then. To get into, I saw both the Our Man Flint and Men Like Flint and Barbara Ella at the Meyerland. And I had a cousin that was a year younger than me, but he looked 3 years older than me, easy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he had hair when he was 10 years old. That's how I got in. See, we didn't have a rating system, but there were certain movies that the movie house themselves, they would have a corporate thing that you would have to be with somebody that was at least 17 or whatever it was. So my cousin, I guess, would pass for that. I don't know. But by being with him, I got in to see those movies. And boy, we snickered about that stuff a lot. Mm-hmm. I think we saw Our Man Flint 6 or 7 times. And saw Barbara Ella until they closed the theater. You know? Woohoo, that was something. And then I think it was the very next summer that Our Man Flint came out. And of course, we were the first ones in line to see that too. I would visit this particular cousin about 2 weeks out of every summer. And I stayed at their house. We were pretty tight for those 2 weeks. And of course, back in those days, I thought that my older cousins were aunts and uncles. So I was slow. It was probably about the time I joined the service that I finally stopped and gave it some thought. Wait a minute, these people can't be my aunts and uncles.
So with me, I want to say I might have seen Moonraker in the theater. My mother used to drag me on dates and stuff with her. But I saw so much Star Wars related
stuff, like wannabe sci-fi stuff, which Moonraker kind of was. You know, it might have just been part of that whole phase of knockoffs.
Well, and you saw so many, when you were around me and your brothers, you saw a lot of, we'd go on movie marathons, because that was the business I was in at the time.
Yeah. But I remember Channel 13, ABC, used to always have the Bond movies.
13 is KPRC, right?
Yeah, ABC.
Yeah, they were the ones with the million-dollar movies in the afternoon and would have the late movies.
But I'm talking about, like, ABC Primetime would have the James Bond stuff, though. They didn't have that stuff on the million-dollar movie back in the day. Million-dollar movie, when I was a kid, was always the shitty low-budget 70s movies and then the old stuff from the 40s and, you know, like...
Bachelor in Paradise, tomorrow's million-dollar movie.
Welcome to the 3 o'clock Million Dollar Movie, Houston's greatest movie showcase. This afternoon, holiday week begins with two married lawyers who battle wits at home and in the courtroom. Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn star in Adam's Rib.
Generally, they're late night movies. Back in the days when they'd roll up the sidewalk, that was the only channel that had stuff. Tell you the truth, I'm not sure I remember what you're talking about. You know, I didn't watch much TV in the 70s until about the mid-80s. I always had someplace else to be. I remember stuff like that going on during Roger Moore's reign.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember it with the Sean Connery movies.
Well, and that makes sense, because Roger Moore was James Bond when I was a kid. Sean Connery was that guy from the old movies that they didn't show as often.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember with Dr. No, I think they showed it one time, and I got maybe 10 minutes into it. And it's like, why is James Bond wearing a hat? Why does he look weird? I couldn't get into it. So Roger Moore was so much Bond for me that one of those ABC Sunday night movies, they showed a movie that they retitled. I think they called it Strike Force when it came out on ABC. When it was in theaters, I think it was a bomb called Folks.
He's a master strategist.
I am telling you how to save the lives of 600 men.
Demolitions expert.
Get onto the diving section. Tell them I want a wetsuit and a berry gun.
And he doesn't need a license to kill.
Except for a slight squelch when entering the flesh. They do not make any noise.
Roger Moore fights against time and terror as Folks.
Have I ever let you down?
No.
What's he like?
Very odd.
Cheers.
On the other hand, I suspect that you picked the right man for the job.
A wise decision, I assure you.
The Target.
We're taking command of this ship, Captain. Nobody's going to get hurt if they do exactly what they're told.
The Plan.
We want the British government to pay us a ransom. If anyone takes any action against us, everything goes up immediately.
The Mission.
If I say I will get my men to the wheelhouse unobserved, I will do so.
The Man.
Yesterday, one man completed the exercise. Today, you will all complete the exercise.
Folks is fearless.
There are over 600 people relying on us to save their lives.
Folks is fatal.
Kramer and his odious colleagues will be dead.
Folks is fantastic.
Three. Two. One. Go!
If you want action,
nothing will go wrong.
If you want danger,
now have the money here on time or the whole North Sea will be on fire.
If you want adventure,
everything is to go as planned.
If you want excitement, you want Folks.
My God!
Roger Moore, James Mason, Anthony Perkins, Michael Parks. Folks, he doesn't need a license to kill.
Roger Moore had a full beard. He was running around in like a knit cap. And I think he was part of like an anti-terrorist group or maybe a black ops group. And Anthony Perkins was a terrorist that had taken like a boat, I think, or a lighthouse or something. And I think at the end, Moore shoots him with a harpoon gun and kills him. And then he's meeting with, I think, Her Majesty's... somebody from the government, and they give him like a kitten as a present at the end of the movie. So it's like, oh, hey, he's still James Bond. He got pussy in the end. But obviously it wasn't a James Bond movie, but because it had Roger Moore in it, my brain just assumed that it was another Bond flick. That's how much Moore was my Bond. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time. It was weird for me when Timothy Dalton came around, because forget Sean Connery, it was always about Roger Moore when I was a kid. And they like I said, they pushed those movies hard. They were still big hits at that point. They hadn't gone through that dry spell they went through in the 80s yet. And so it was all about Moore. James Bond was like a role model, you know? You knew he wasn't for you when you were a kid. You knew that they didn't have any merchandising for James Bond. I couldn't buy an action figure or anything like that. You could always tell that that was the adult's action hero, the grown man's action hero. And you could enjoy that, but it wasn't made for you as a kid. It wasn't like... Kind
of, well, a lot of times the comedy relief in Bond, and let's face it, it was full of it.
Mm-hmm. Especially and, during Roger Moore's
period. Well, it's just like a lot of people never think about this, but when you do, you know it's right. James Bond is science fiction.
Especially as it progresses, yeah.
Yeah.
But like I said, Moonraker is basically a Star Wars ripoff. You know, because obviously we couldn't do anything. We still can't do much of what was in Moonraker scientifically.
Right.
And they had laser pistols and stuff, too, as I recall. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it definitely. They've got a subgenre, too, they call sci-spy, where it's you've got the more grounded Robert Ludlum's type spy movies. And then you had the just wildly ridiculous science fiction stuff that Mike Myers was making fun of with the Austin Powers movies.
Yeah.
And our man Flint was like that, too.
Well, the original film version of Casino Royale, same thing. It's like you compare that to the Austin Powers or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out during Sean Connery's reign.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a bunch of that. Of course, I've got all the versions. I have the original, in the special features, I have the original Casino Royale that was in black and white that was on TV.
Yeah, there was like a CBS showcase or something.
And it was kind of like, you could compare it like to a Hallmark.
Yeah, wasn't it an American who played Bond in that too?
Oh yeah, I think it was the same guy that was supposed to be the original James Kirk.
Oh, was Christopher Hunter?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh. Jeremy Hunter.
Yeah. And of course, that was back in the day, the early, I don't think it was videotape, I think it was film. Like a lot of stuff from those days, it was every bit as bad as like the old Avengers or those old shows that you can buy on DVD now, where they haven't cleaned them up digitally. It's kind of hard to see.
Mm.
So I've got all three of those in my DVD collection, including the modern one. Sometimes I think that you overthink these things, but, you know, that's one of those things where I'll do a comparative and do the same kind of overthinking myself. It's kind of fun. It makes me feel like I'm researching history, which is something I like to do. Look. I come from an era when Davy Jones was a sex symbol. You know, this little bitty skinny British guy. I can remember that the only time Americans found the Brits ridiculous was when Twiggy came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, voluptuous women were in back then. We were just discussing that in this last film, and we've discussed it in Bond films.
Uh-huh.
You look at the women then that was considered really great and compare them to the women today that are considered really great, although now that tits and booties are back in, you know, they're getting back up to the voluptuous again.
Yeah.
But when Twiggy came out, I mean, you would have to be there. If you were from my era, when they showed that to the American public, and she was already getting all this press, you know, I think she was really popular like in France and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Man, they were saying, what the heck is she?
The androgynous.
She's a toothpick. You know, there's nothing to Twiggy. But she got a lot of press because of it. But she was, as far as the American public was concerned, quite laughable. But up until that time, anything British was just... When you look at the Stones back then, the Stones were not what they became. Because I remember thinking, I was not a Stones fan. You know, I wasn't even a Beatles fan. I think it was 68, 69 before I started getting into the Beatles.
you're talking about culturally Americans were very open to Brits, but how were you individually? If you weren't into the Stones, you weren't into the Beatles, did you keep it at arm's length?
I liked everything British, okay?
Yeah.
All right? But I was into the chicks. If you look at the British chicks in Disney films, I thought every one of them was hot.
You're Julie Andrews
there
guy.
There was just nothing. Oh, Julie Andrews, man. There was nothing sexier on the planet than Julie Andrews. And she wasn't the only one. There was a whole bunch of British chicks, most of them not so skinny, you know what I mean? That I just thought was really cool. I can remember back then. I mean, I didn't particularly like the Beatles, but I wanted a pair of them boots. I'll guarantee you.
I like those Italian shoes, too. Those mini boots with the zips.
Yeah, well, see, I wear Italian shoes now.
Yeah.
But back then, they weren't Italian shoes. Those were Beatle boots.
Yeah.
Girls had go-go boots. I wanted some Beatle boots. And you know, I never got them.
No?
Never got them. Nope.
From Russia, with love.
You look at people today and the right-wing conservative, these Christians, you know, it's okay to kill a Muslim. And some of them go so far, because in my time, it was okay to kill a Jew. I mean, they were going to hell anyway.
That's one of the things they're trying to bring back to make America great again. So let's go back to killing some Jews, too. They really feel like they let them slip through their fingers.
At the same time, we're going to get, in 1965, in fact, that when this movie came out, I was in military school. You had to go to church if you went to this school. My parents said that I was a Baptist, so I had to go to the Baptist church. You know, in Tennessee, you were either Baptist or Church of Christ, and everybody else was going to go to hell. I can remember the woman that run the...
So wait, was Church of Christ the Mormons?
No, Church of Christ isn't Mormon.
Okay, that's why I don't know. So what is Church of Christ?
There's probably nothing more right-wing than Church of Christ. There is a difference between the Church of Christ here and the Church of Christ in Tennessee at the time.
Okay.
Church of Christ and Baptist, when it comes to looking at people as sinners, I guess you would call it, Baptists look at things like, once you've been saved, you're always saved. That's one of their big things. You get saved, you're always saved, but there's nothing wrong with being saved again.
Right.
You can do that, but it's not necessary. Once saved, always saved. Church of Christ looks at it in a more pragmatic way. They have what they call backsliders.
Backslider! Sorry, little song. Cody's.
You're only saved as long as you continue. In other words, Catholics, you can't be saved if you run to the priest every week and he tell you, okay, you confess, so now you're saved again. Just going under the water one time's not good enough. Yeah. You've got to keep it up.
Yeah.
You know, not that I totally disagree with that, but they're very strict on that. But at the same time, they're really into capitalism. In this part of the country, the Church of Christ churches are usually some of the smaller in congregation. But at the same time, there's probably more Lincolns than Cadillacs out there.
Right.
I went to both churches because when we lived in Tennessee, our neighbor was Church of Christ, and that's how I could get to church. And that's why I know so much about it. Getting back, we digress again.
How did we get here? I forgot at this point. We're talking about Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. My Sunday school teacher looked me square in the face. I'll never forget this because, you know, my journey in faith was a long one. And this is one of my pivotal moments where something clicked in my head. She looked me square in the face. She says, "Well, you know that Jesus was a Gentile just like you and me." And, you know, I just got done reading the Bible in front of the Sunday school class there. It said right there he's a Gentile. And I couldn't see how he was a Gentile like her and me. Because I was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and she was blonde-haired and blue-eyed. I'd probably said something back, but she was really good-looking, too. And I noticed that. I just kind of stood there with my mouth open going, well, you know, I don't know what's going on, but she looks good walking away from me. So Kiss
Think
Kiss.
Pure thoughts, chum. Think pure thoughts.
Hey, you know, well, I wouldn't have known what to do with it back then anyway, so.
I don't know what it is, but I know I want some of it.
Yeah, that was it. I'm noticing it a lot.
I'm just going to hug it for now, but maybe later I'll figure something else
out.
Yeah,
buddy. And Bond movies poked fun at a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, somebody was going to notice that could be a dirty reference, and it's just not going to fly.
Well, isn't that how they got away with it in Rock and Roll, is the Squares didn't know that a bang was a bang, sexual bang, as opposed to a gun bang? I mean, I didn't even register the sexual bang until just now.
There was a lot of stuff in music that if you listen to some of the music, like Mamas and the Papas, they would make reference to some of the stuff going on. Sonny and Cher did it. I was trying to think of who else did it, but you had to make your reference.
Coded.
It was coded, yeah. And that led, because I was there, I know, I told those lies like everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff in the music that really, sometimes it was there, but most of the time it really wasn't.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite ones is the song Crystal Blue Persuasion.
Uh-huh.
We just thought that was a drug song.
Uh-huh.
10, 15 years after the fact, I see a dadgum interview where they're talking about it. He's making a reference to the Bible.
Huh?
Yeah, Crystal Blue Persuasion is in the Bible.
Where is that? What is that?
Well, since we weren't talking, I could normally, if we were talking Bible, I could be
you'd
right
be in that
on
wavelength.
Top of that.
You're kind of, yeah, you're still focusing on
we'll
the.
We'll get into that in another time.
You're still thinking of the Gentile teacher from school.
Yeah, really, I am. I mean, we're going from the lampoon to the serious here.
Well, but it's funny you mentioned that. I don't know if you ever got around to watching Breaking Bad, but they use Crystal Blue Persuasion in reference to the blue meth that the lead character cooks, and it was like they were building to this moment of playing that song, and it was a very iconic moment when they finally did get around to playing that song, and they made it into a drug reference regardless of the intention
right.
of the creator. Of course, it's like 40 years later, but you know,
well,
50 almost, I think.
And the Beatles did. I mean, there was a lot of music that referenced drugs.
Yeah.
Lucy
in the Sky with Diamonds. That's a little more obvious one.
Well, and let's face it. There was a time when the Beatles were all junkies. They were hanging out in India doing heroin. And I mean, they wrote songs about it. Everybody's got something to hide except me and my monkey.
Yeah. I need a fix because I'm going down.
Yeah, but see, that's kind of later.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and so it took some of them later, but most of them kicked heroin. I don't know if you ever saw that interview, but they kicked heroin in this long drive inside a limousine. They actually had bad withdrawals and everything, but, you know, it was like...
At least they're doing it in a limousine.
I can't remember now the reference of why they did it in the limousine, but it had something to do with not being able to score.
Okay.
They take off, instead of taking a plane or a bus or whatever the heck, train, whatever, I think it was a train. Instead of taking the train, they took this limo.
They're in a limo in Tucson, Arizona, where you need to go.
It was like an all-night drive or something. Uh-huh. There'd be no way to score. There'd be no, because otherwise they'd find a way and they knew it. But apparently they all had this bad habit and had to be cured of it before the next gig or whatever. I can't remember, but I know that a lot of that stuff that took place in India had to do with clearing up. But of course, we all know that Lennon was doing crap almost right up to the time he died. But it's Paul McCartney. He was a really bad chain smoker. If he didn't have some kind of good genes, he should have been dead a long time ago. But he,
well, I assume Lennon McCartney did a lot to help clean him up too.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, you know, but I can remember when he was still with Wings talking about what a bad smoker he was.
Mm-hmm.
He's smoking like 10 packs a day or something.
Wow.
So, yeah. He was an actual chain smoker.
Yeah.
Talking about that, we told those lies when I was a kid. We actually believed all the crap that came out of our mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, stuff got explained.
Well, that's so amazing. I was talking to Mr. Fixit the other night, and we were talking about how things were before the internet, before you could just go and find out what the truth was about something. But what's weird, it's something in human
nature, but you've got all these falsehoods, these easily cleared up falsehoods, things like
and
flat
the internet
earth theory,
hasn't really helped that.
Not only hasn't it helped, but in some ways it helps to proliferate
there
this
you go.
Ridiculous bullshit that was disproven hundreds of years
well,
ago.
Well, your aunt, is the big one to go to that site.
Like Snopes.com or something?
Yeah, that's it. That's one of her favorites.
It's a damn good place to go.
Well, she checks all that crap
I mean,
out.
Just the for instance, I was in a class a few years back, and the teacher was talking about having heard from like brother or cousin or something when he was in Vietnam. About the Vietnamese prostitutes hiding blades in their vaginas, you know, to cut people with and all this kind of shit. And I kind of walked up and said,
I'm glad I didn't meet any of them.
Right. Well, I went up and I talked to her because I'd researched that years ago. And it's like, it's bullshit. It's like a bizarre variation on vagina dentata going back to Freud. And this circulated
in both
Vietnam.
The Philippines and Vietnam.
Yeah.
You would go to some of these clubs that might have an act where the old gal would pick up a coin off of a Coke bottle or a beer bottle.
Well, famously, the movie Emmanuel, you've got the girl smoking a cigarette with her vagina. And you know,
I didn't see that one.
You never saw Emmanuel?
No.
Of all the things, you never saw Emmanuel? Yeah, she smokes a cigarette with her vagina, which that's a rough way to get cervical cancer. Jesus. But and I think she also picks up ping pong balls or something with it as well, if I remember correctly. Or I might be confusing that with a heavy metal
story. I saw a chick. I don't think it was a ping pong ball. I think it was a Jack's ball. But she picked it up, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I actually, one night in a club in the Philippines, it was called the Top Three. And a buddy of mine, this chick was dancing on the stage, picking stuff up off of bottles. Guys would hold it out on their finger and stuff. And he laid down on the floor with a 10 peso bill or whatever, put it across his face, said, "Pick this up!" She did. I remember his name, but you notice I didn't tell that name.
Good man. He may have family out there that doesn't need to know this.
Nah, I'm pretty sure this guy's dead. He was crazy. And he lived in California, so.
Okay. So Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang wouldn't fly.
Yeah, just because of the title alone was going to be a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about it. You go, that was 65. I can't remember the exact year. It's probably at least 7-8 years after that. Johnny Cash cut this song called Boy Named Sue.
Right, classic.
Couldn't say son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And shoot, they say
the version I got from you is bleeped. I don't know if I've ever found an unedited. I think I did finally find an unedited version.
Well, I had the original 45 at the time.
Yeah.
And it was not bleeped. Okay. But yeah, I thought it was very strange that it was bleeped on that compilation that I got. But that's how you always heard it. Couldn't say son of a bitch. There's a lot of things you couldn't say.
I think
say.
You could say son of a. It was that last part that was giving the trouble.
They always said son of a gun. Son of a gun was all right. I never got it, but it was all right. I mean, you saw it on old Westerns. They say son of a
sure.
gun.
There's white bread coating, too.
You could, a word like bitch, you couldn't.
No.
You know, they might say cur dog. They would never call a dog bitch, even though everybody, it was a proper term. But
yeah.
No, in fact, when I was a kid, a youngster would never say the word bitch. In fact, almost everything comes out of a kid's mouth nowadays. They'd knocked our head off.
Things couldn't suck back in the day.
No, I'd be talking through my nose and it'd be somewhere on my back shoulder blade or something. One time I was in the, I got a story about saying son of a bitch when I was, about 12 years old. I'm in the car with your grandmother. Back in those days, nobody wore a seatbelt. Usually your mother, your father, whoever's in the car, when they stepped on the brake, their arm come across.
Yeah, short stop.
Yeah.
We're stopping short.
We were on our way to San Antonio to see this family that our family and their family were real tight from way back. It was like my father was best friends with this other father, and me and his son were best friends. Anyway, we're on our way and we're talking about it, and I referenced the father. I probably repeated word for word something my father said, and I said, "Yeah, that old son of a bitch, man. The arm came across, but this time it was almost a fist, and it hit me so hard my head bounced off of the passenger side window."
Oh.
I mean, my bell was rung.
Mm-hmm.
It was really funny, too, because the next thing would have been screaming at me or something, but she saw my face and realized I had not a clue what I did.
there it lies. You know, what the parents, my father said son of a bitch and GD and all kinds of things all the time. And I know my wife did too. He was Southern Baptist and he was a deacon of the church. He said it.
So Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang
would not fly.
Right.
This is a Samsonite briefcase that I got from a yard sale. I think I paid $5 for it. I put a sticker on the front, 007. I'm trying to kind of make somewhat of a replica of the briefcase from the movie From Russia with Love. If you remember in the movie, Q gives James Bond a briefcase that has a gun and a throwing knife and some gold sovereigns and some ammunition inside of it. So I'll go kind of go through each thing that's in there. Of course, there's the Armalite AR-7, which is the same gun featured in the movie. It's actually in three different James Bond movies.
Twice that Krylenko has tried to kill me. The third time he will succeed, unless I get him first. And that I'll do tonight.
Not with that arm, you won't. You'd better leave it to me.
I'm already too much in your debt.
How can a friend be in debt? Here.
Infrared lens. He has a private escape hatch. Arm or no arm, I have to pull that trigger.
Well, you think you can? You've got one shot, remember?
It'll have to do.
Quick, he's coming.
Pays many debts.
Why don't we do the weapons first, and then you can edit it into wherever you want it.
You know, you've got the sniper rifle that they use in the movie.
Yeah.
And that's it's nothing but a wooden stock in the movie, and all of the other parts to the rifle are built into that wooden stock.
Right.
What I've got in my hands right now is a plastic stock. This is a modern version of the same device.
That's
right. What is this exactly?
Okay, this is a Henry survival rifle.
Mm-hmm.
See, over the one in the movie is an Armalite 7.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back in the 70s, I bought one that Armalite was still making that were used by our military in Vietnam for when they needed a lightweight, go under the water weapon. Those were Armalites too, made by the same company.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was an AR-18 then. And I purchased one in California as soon as I came back from Vietnam. This is the Henry. Since the 70s, the rights to producing the gun have shifted to other companies. And now the Henry company owns the patent on it, and they're still producing the same gun. There's just because it's a black plastic stock, when you pull the butt off, you can it all assembles the same way.
Before we start doing that too, I was curious. Now, this plastic version has the stock, and then it also has a handle. Did the version from the movie have the handle as well?
Yeah.
It looked to me like it was just the triangular stock.
No.
Okay. And how are you meant to carry this?
It usually goes like in a backpack.
Okay, so you would just have this in the backpack and you'd pull it out
right.
And start assembling it from there.
Right.
So you're not really intending to carry this as is. You know, the whole point is to have it out of the way until you need it.
Right.
Okay. So how do I get this thing open?
You just pull the butt plate off. It just comes off just like it did in the movie.
Okay.
Okay. And I would slide the chamber out first. There you go.
Okay. And you've got this bright orange, safety orange with the open.
Well, pot. Yeah, now they make them that way.
Okay.
Okay.
So then I would slide this into place?
You just slide it into place just like they did in the movie. Oh. The lower section, see, it just thread right on in there.
Okay.
Now, this, just like in the movie, turn the screw right there.
Okay. How do I know when to stop? Is
you
going to stop turning?
When it tightens up,
when
where
it's finger
really
tight, it'll actually. Okay.
It'll be plenty tight.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, and then you pull the barrel out, just like in the movie, and push it onto the front there. There's little notch, just like...
Yeah, that's what I saw when I was pulling this part out. Okay, yeah.
And then just turn it like you were putting on a piece of plumbing pipe.
Okay, I'm still seeing thread, though, so... Is it supposed to be flush, I assume?
Well, they put that plastic safety piece on there now.
Okay.
That would explain it.
You gotta, see, it's got the...
You don't really need to look for that little...
when you've got the bright orange sight, you should be going by that.
When the bright orange sight notch inside the top of the rifle or where it should be. And then you just rotate it and tighten it down. Okay, and there you go. And then you have a...
And that's a 22, it looks like?
This is 22. Yeah. The original one was a 22.
I didn't I didn't appreciate how tiny the muzzle was on this thing. It looks like a toy.
Well,
you know?
Mistakenly, back then, I read this. I didn't know this. But mistakenly, they identified it as a 25 caliber in the movie, but it's not. It's a.
They said 25 in the movie?
Huh?
I didn't realize that.
I read something. I didn't hear it either, but yeah. I read something. But see, just like in the movie, see, you have a little plastic strip of shells. And you have another magazine.
So you have to actually rip open the package like it was jerky or something to get
you
the
don't,
bullets.
You don't. See, you have this because this gun, it floats. If you drop it in the water, it floats.
Mm-hmm.
The original gun actually had a Bakelite stock, and Bakelite didn't float.
Mm-hmm.
So what you saw in the movie was the veneered or varnished wood stock because wood floats.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the plastics in the 60s that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
You can also carry two magazines and preload the magazines if you so desired.
Well, you're reminding me, too, Marvel Comics used to put out a comic called The Nam, which was chronicling month by month the experiences of a soldier in Vietnam. And they used to have a glossary in the letters column where they were talking about how the M16s were made by Mattel, joking that they weren't used to these plastic pieces on their guns and kind of mocking that aspect of it.
Well, there were several things, and one of the things that I don't know if it's ever been mentioned in movies, but in truth, they had problems with the M16, you know, stuff getting in the guns, and soldiers, when I was there, would get prophylactics, which is you know, the military would supply.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a lot cheaper than the curing the clap, from what I understand.
Well, and that's why the military would supply them. I mean, you could go to one of the stores on base and buy some other kind of prophylactic, but they had basic prophylactics. Mm-hmm. If I remember, they were Trojans.
Okay.
And the soldiers would put the prophylactic over the barrel of the M16 and then tape it down.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about a prophylactic, they didn't have to worry about jerking it off when they shot it. You know, because it didn't cause blowback like a lot of other things.
Uh-huh.
Also, there was you know,
well, when
air.
You say like a lot of other things, what were you expected to use if you weren't using a prophylactic?
Well, that was the whole problem, see. They needed to put something over the barrel to keep foreign objects from getting in there. And if you plug a barrel of a rifle, you'll get blowback. It'll turn into a pipe bomb.
Yeah, especially if you're trying to shoot on the you know, like somebody's shooting at you and you're trying to return fire. You don't have time to think, oh, let me take my little plunger.
Right, and I remember that, you know, you never know if a story's true or not. But the story was some soldier, you know, the old prophylactics, and I think they still make some like that, were made out of sheepskin.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You can still buy sheepskin
condoms,
yeah.
Right, which is not rubber, it's semi-porous.
Yes,
you know?
It is. It's not good for... It's supposed to help with pregnancy, but it's not very good for venereal disease.
Right, right.
Or any good, actually,
and
from what I understand.
The guy was supposed to be a farmer or something that knew this. I heard one version where he made his own sausage, so you know, he knew about it. And he surmised because it was porous, you wouldn't get blowback.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, the prophylactic is so thin, and there is air trapped in it. So when the shell expands, I mean, there's nothing to really hold that pressure in the barrel,
mm-hmm.
and it will just blow the end off of it. And you would see guys carrying the rifles that would have melted prophylactic on there. But that one, now, you know, the one I had was of a different kind of plastic, and the stock was made to look like wood.
Mm-hmm.
My stock was actually heavier than the stock on this one.
Yeah.
But these barrels, one of the things about Armalite is they made those barrels, what kept their weapons light is they're actually aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And like an aluminum block engine, they sleeve it with the steel that the bullet travels down.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the movie, the rifle is rested on Sean Connery's shoulder while his partner is actually firing the weapon.
Right.
If you're, how would you be expected to fire this on your own? Would you be looking
like any other rifle? In fact,
so where would you hold? Like what? Like this? Would you hold it
like that, or like the guy started cross your arm and lean it up against the tree and shoot it like that? You use it like any other kind of rifle.
How comfortable is this to fire?
Oh, it's very comfortable. I mean, when it pops off, it's a .22. Mm-hmm. It's got enough weight to it. You don't feel any kind of recoil or anything. Mm-hmm. It's quite comfortable.
And the range?
I would say effective range for actually killing something other than maybe a squirrel would be about 100 yards.
Okay.
So the shot...
No, and in the movie it's a body shot. You were telling me you would want to do a headshot or
Yeah, they would. You would use a solid nose, 55 grain instead of a 40 grain, and you would make it a headshot, preferably the ear.
Because you wanted to penetrate and then bounce around inside to do a job.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, in the movie, if you'd shot from that range into the body, would it have penetrated a thick jacket like he had?
Probably not. A suit jacket, it might penetrate the suit jacket, you know. It might actually get embedded in the upper, you know, in the epidermis.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are of it actually going in the body. I mean, it's possible. I mean, there's a lot of things possible. But I have known people. I knew a guy who was a backdoor man. This man's husband knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw him and took a .22 rifle, just about one about that size, and emptied it into the guy. And they were probably no more than 25 or 30 feet apart. Mm-hmm. It was in front of a house. And every bullet hit the man's breastplate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wore, you know, you've seen those Spider-Man outfits with the spider on the chest and the legs coming out?
Yeah.
He had a scar just like that. I swear, it looked just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was where the bullets kept hitting his breastplate and going out the side under the epidermis.
Right.
And it left the Spider-Man's scar on his chest.
And you're saying this is like 25 feet?
Like 25, 30 feet, yeah.
And the guy... I assume at least six shots, and nothing actually penetrated. Well,
it was a 7-shot 22 rifle.
Okay,
it was a 22 automatic.
But it was all superficial damage.
Yeah, it was not internal damage really.
Yeah.
It just bounced and went up.
Now clearly, I would assume he was trying to kill the man.
Yeah, he was trying to kill the guy, and all the guy was wearing was a T-shirt.
Yeah,
and I knew these people.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, they remained friends. You know, after the guy divorced the woman. But yeah, I knew him. I knew that it was a true story.
So, in the circumstances depicted in the film, this would not really be an ideal weapon unless you had the aim to make it function.
No, but you see, if you look at, you know, people used to read police stories a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the favorite weapons to do away with somebody by a mafioso back in the day would be a double tap to the back of the head.
Right.
Now, you are talking at a pistol, you know, within just a couple of feet of the back of the head. But that was their preferred thing. They got right at the base of the skull so that it didn't hit the, you know, it went up like where the spine was, and double tap them with a .22.
Mm-hmm.
It's clean. It's a lot quieter. You know, no big blood splatter, that kind of stuff. And that's how they like to do it.
Well, at that range, you could probably kill somebody with a BB gun if you put it in the temple, right?
Well, but you see, that's the thing. People think, because people are always doing it to the side of the head.
Yeah.
That is, if you're determined to kill somebody or you're committing suicide, that ain't the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's your frontal lobe.
Yeah.
You know, you can survive that. I knew a guy that survived that. He tried to commit suicide, shot himself in the head. In fact, it was just about this time of year. He was alone at home, and he was high, and he already suffered from depression. He put a gun to his head, and he pulled the trigger. The .22 went in there, took out a good chunk of his frontal lobe, and he wore the bullet. You know, he could still, at his age, he could still be alive for his, you know, because he is about my age.
Mm-hmm.
But the bullet lodged in the back of the brain, they didn't even bother to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
And he survived. Yeah. He spent about a month in Bentall Hospital.
Any permanent effect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he wasn't really right to begin with, but yeah, it was like a partial lobotomy or something.
So what did it do to him long term?
Well, you know, he kind of slow and like he was never really with you in the room. You know, mm-hmm. he could talk to you, but it was like he was never really interested. It was just he was doing his due diligence.
He didn't try it again. I guess, you know, it had some effect.
As far as I know, no, he didn't try it again, but he liked downers. You know, this was like, I don't know, 1977, 78, mm-hmm. something like that. And he liked downers, and he suffered from depression. He was home alone. And his gun was not a dead gum 22. I'm sorry, it was a 22. I was thinking of another guy. Yeah. You know, I've known several people that tried to do that. I knew a guy that tried to do it with a 38 at Temple. It went right through it. And he had even less effect than this guy with the 22.
Yeah. So where would you put it then?
Put it right up underneath your chin. You want it to go straight up. Mm-hmm. And 22, that close.
Medulla oblongata.
Yeah, it'd take out the, you know, because 22, once it gets in the brain cavity, it just keeps bouncing off.
Well, I mean, it makes sense because you take out the autonomic function, you're going to stop breathing, your heart stops beating. That's the core of the brain. So if the rest of your body doesn't function, you're going to die regardless of the state of the brain itself. So it makes sense.
Right, yeah.
But in the mafia scenario, let's say you're taking like a 22 or a BB gun, you say in the back of the head?
Yeah, they would do right at the base of the mm-hmm. skull. Because you know where the...
At the spinal column cord, where you've got the opening for...
Yeah, you break that spinal connection, it just lights out.
Yeah.
You know, the bullet might go in the brain, but it doesn't have to. I had to put away a dog one time. That's where I shot him. The dog was dead. His heart continued to beat.
Yeah.
Which means I didn't prop, and I was using a 45.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then again, I've never been an assassin, so, you know, my skill in such things is probably questionable.
Yeah. It is really light, though.
Yes, it is.
It's actually much lighter built, I guess, because of the balance than when it's in the handle.
Well, you know that they used Armalite. The military used Armalite ARs in 223 during Desert Storm and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that's what kind of happened to the company is other people started making ARs. And, you know, ARs is a big business. A lot of people own them. Your brother-in-law that owns that rifle right there, he has several ARs, you know, and he's talking about building another one.
It's interesting, too. I'm noticing the sight. You mm-hmm. basically have this pinhole sight.
Right.
You can almost see nothing through it, but what you can find is the orange tip for aiming.
And you really don't need a scope. At 100 yards, if you have decent eyesight, that will get it done.
I see, too, the longer you stare at the pinhole, the better you have it lined up, the greater clarity you have with the orange target.
Right. And, you know, they
so started... basically, if that orange target is filling your little tiny scope, then you're on mark, then.
Yes, as long as it's lined up to what you're...
That is an interesting orange.
Yeah, and they call that kind of sight a peep sight.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what a peep sight is.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a little rail. So if you wanted to put that infrared scope on there...
That would seem like overkill, though. I mean, because that's just an extra bulk. And then you
well,
wouldn't necessarily
you know,
have a place for
I've
it.
Got... I have my Smith & Wesson M&P 1522, which I shoot all the time at my gun club. That's my favorite. It's cheap to shoot, and it's fun. I shoot it at 100 yards. I have it scoped. You know, the thing about a 22 at 100 yards is windage and elevation is definitely a part of it. You know, you get a 20-mile-an-hour gust or even a 5-mile-an-hour gust coming in at the side, and scope or no scope to, you know, 100 yards, you're lucky sometimes to hold a pattern of, say, 4 inches at 100 yards. So it's, you know, it's still challenging.
Once you know what you're doing, I'm impressed by how quickly and easily you did this thing apart again, too.
And you did it one time. Packed right away and good to go. Yeah, this next one, this is mom's Colt. It's a 380.
Fits
Colt.
Neatly in the hand itself. Right. It's shorter Colt than my
pony.
Hand.
It's a Colt pony, but in size, weight, and feel, it's very comparable to the PPK.
I can definitely see this being a comfortable carry weapon.
Well, the
and it's not much bigger than the inside of my palm. It's basically the size of my palm and about half to three quarters of my middle and trigger fingers.
But it is heavy enough that if you put it in your pocket,
yeah,
you can
feel the bulk on it. Yeah,
so
yeah, definitely.
Using a holster that would take that weight would. And you fired that gun.
I was going to say, I thought that I'd fired this one.
Yeah,
did I like it? I don't remember if I liked this
one.
Yeah,
you liked it fine, but you went back to my 1911.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was your favorite gun. And it's basically a miniature version.
And but, this is another one, though, that is more for close range.
Oh, yeah. Now, that one's like the PPK, you know, rather than... You know, most of those guns, as we discussed before, you're really looking at a 20-foot gun.
Yeah.
You know? But you watch Mama shoot that, she's usually shooting at 30 to 35 feet, and she's holding about a 2-inch pattern, so mm-hmm. that ought to tell you something.
So... During the gypsy sequence in the movie, when Bond's using the Walther, he's shooting at a fair further out than 20 feet.
That's right. And look,
but not necessarily effectively. A lot of those shots weren't actually taken.
Were missing, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. I would say the maximum effective range in the hand of somebody like Bond that's supposed to be an expert
mm-hmm.
would be about 50 feet. Okay. Now, effective range and actual range are two different things.
Right.
You know, and they were in a compound where the wind was being blocked.
Right.
So if he had time, you know.
He was taking his time, too. They made that clear that he was being deliberate with the shots.
That's, you know, that's one of the things that people don't understand. I see the movie stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A trained shooter that is taking his time and not allowing the combat around him, you can't let that affect you.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody really trained and really good, there's a very good chance that, you know, 75 feet would be not a shot you can miss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's in the hands of an expert and a cool hit.
Well, and it's not clear that when he does connect that they're kill shots. I mean, if you get shot in the belly or something, you're probably going to be out of the fight.
But you're also talking about a movie.
Right.
That gun holds 6 shots.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you're preloading it, you know, a lot... With gun people now, they always go plus one. So it's a 7 shot if you've already got one in the chamber, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how many times did you see 007 pull a magazine out of his
pocket? No, not at any point, does it?
Where is his extra magazines? How is mm-hmm. he loading to make all those shots?
Right.
You know?
Well, he doesn't shoot that often, though. I mean, a lot of it is little tricks like the rolling, firing, wagging at people, tipping over the table, cutting the fence down. So I know he's making more than 6-7 shots.
At least 3 magazines worth.
Okay.
Trust
oh,
me.
You were counting. Okay.
Well, and see, that's it. When I taught you how to shoot, didn't I teach you to count your shots?
Oh, sure. Now, this is an empty magazine. How much does this weigh with IMO?
It adds, I don't know, maybe 4 to 5 ounces of weight.
Okay. So if you're running around in a suit like he is, could you get away with like 3 or 4 of these in the suit? Or it'd be kind of noticeable, wouldn't it?
No, well, the thing is, they have those, and I think he's supposed to be wearing one. The shoulder holster has a place for 2 or 3 or 4 magazines.
Okay.
You know.
So you wouldn't necessarily be able to detect that, especially if he's used to
carrying
that way.
Yeah, like FBI agents, you know, a lot of them will carry, they may be wearing a shoulder holster,
mm-hmm.
but then they're carrying on their belt, maybe inside, they're wearing one of those on a clip inside the small of their back. They're carrying a couple of extra magazines.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like standard.
Yeah.
Police do it, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like police usually have a holdout strapped to their ankle or something.
Mm-hmm. Is there any... We've done the weapons before.
Well,
those are the extended...
We can talk about the smaller gun.
Well, too, let me see those magazines. These are the extended magazines, right?
They're extended magazines.
Let me see the gun.
You could get them for the Walters, too. They're 10-shot magazines. So you would notice it if he was wearing an extended magazine. But it does make...
Well, I mean, that's like a quarter of the length of the...
Well, but if you feel the way it feels with that magazine, then put the smaller magazine, you can have more control and it's a lot more comfortable because you have a better grip.
I was noticing that, yeah. But you couldn't. This wouldn't be a good quick draw, though.
Oh no, yeah. It wouldn't look good in a suit.
This is what you'd have to put in after you're in the comic.
Yeah, situation. you might
after the gun's already drawn. Yeah, and you shot
might,
a few people.
You might,
then
your
you can
extra
those.
Magazines in the small of your back might be extended magazines.
Yeah,
and loaded those weigh, I don't know, maybe 14 ounces. Feels a whole lot better. Yeah. A lot more.
Well, I mean, it's like you say. This is Mama's gun. So in a guy's hand, this feels a little
slight. Yeah, it's not even
slight.
Mama's favorite gun.
Yeah.
But she does like it. I bought me that 1911, and I, you know how I am about fairness, and I decided Mama had to have something that she, you know, the 1911 was a little bit bigger than she liked. So we went to one of those hole-in-the-wall arms people. They had that, and they had it at a real good price, so I bought it. And the other gun they used, as we discussed, when I was reading up on it, just curious, it was a Beretta 418, and it was in 6.5 millimeters. And it was similar to that small Taurus 380 that I was letting you hold last night,
mm-hmm.
only, you know, it was a 25 caliber in our calibration. That one was a 6.35 millimeter. You know, I knew somebody had a Beretta 25, and I think the model number was a little bit different, but basically it was the same gun.
Mm-hmm.
As Beretta 418. We are talking about all metal guns. You know, maybe the Armalite has some aluminum on it. The Walter and the Berettas, they didn't have polymers and stuff, and they couldn't. Size determined how much that gun was going to weigh.
Mm-hmm.
And they were heavy steel weapons. I mean, you know, by comparison, I mean, you know, they weigh three or four times what the weapons that most people use today weigh.
Mm-hmm.
Although Walter PPK is still pretty much the same gun. A lot of times you see, and you saw it in this movie, you would see an old Walter 9mm, which looks much like a Luger. You saw one of the bad guys had one in that film. In fact, you see it almost all the time, and especially in those early Bond films. They may not have a Luger handy, and they want a gun that looks like that, so they get an older Walter from the 40s or 50s that looks similar to a Luger.
Secret!
Welcome to James Bonding, the father and son sci-spy. Spy-fi, okay. The father and son spy-fi podcast.
And we'll also, let's go ahead and do a promo too. Tell them what the show's about.
This is old dude, and the program's about whatever he tells me it is.
Well, it's Bonding Agents, and it's a father and son spy-fi podcast.
But he tells me what it is.
Well, no, I mean, go ahead. That's why I was feeding you the info, basically.
Yeah, you were telling me what it is.
Right, so that's all them.
Oh, well, we're talking about spies and stuff.
You're putting nothing in this promo, are you?
I got a cat sniffing my balls. What do you want me to come up for that? Yeah, once or twice a year, my son comes over with his microphone and his digital board and computer, and he wants to bond over things, and since we both watch films and listen to music, that's what we bond over. So this is a discussion. It started out to be over James Bond, but he heard somebody else was doing that. So we're bonding over any kind of spy and pretty much any kind of music, but this is about spies.
The preceding program is intended for the common good at no expense to any citizen. It should therefore be considered to possess a license to thrill in service to fair use, and not seen as a hostile act against copyright owners in the international marketplace. As always, should any of our agents be compromised regardless, we will disavow any knowledge of their activities. This transmission will self-destruct in 5 seconds.